Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Sura Lab. Like I promised, I am making a return after a brief hiatus, and I'm having conversations with more amazing women who work behind the scenes and who drive culture from behind the scenes. And so today I am super excited to welcome today's guest. And so I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on her. She is known throughout the entertainment industry as the ultimate talent whisperer, performance director, hype coach, and energy purveyor. She is an amazing artist development expert. Take it from me, I've seen her in action. You have seen her artist grace stages and touch soul. She has worked with so many major artists, the Lumineers, Polo G, 24 Golden, Sweetie, Justine Skye, Erica Campbell. She's worked with both of the Nazes. I don't know how many people can say that, but she, in case you're wondering what I'm talking about, she's worked with Lil Nas X during a very important period of his career, basically helping him become the star that he is, and with Big Nas, the GOAT that we all know and love. So that's pretty amazing. And in addition, major companies, names that we all are very familiar with, Amazon, Google, BT, TikTok, Revolt, and the list goes on, have tapped her to work with their executive talent and to work with them on their programming. And on top of all of this, somehow she's had time to write a book called The Rose Effect. I'm not sure how she manages to have time to do all these things, but clearly that is something that we're going to need to talk to her about, time management, because it's something she's clearly very skilled in. So everyone, please welcome my dear friend of many years, an amazing, incredibly talented woman, KJ Rose. Yay, he's here. Yes. So as you know, if you've been listening, you know that Sura Lab is about highlighting the women who work behind the scenes, who are driving culture and driving trends. Often they have careers that you're not necessarily familiar with. You might not even know that there are careers that exist, but they are super impactful and you see the results of their work. KJ works with artists by guiding them and coaching them. And, you know, when you go to a show and you're like, oh my God, I feel chills, or this person's bringing tears to my eyes, or wow, I really felt that person. You know, many artists have the ability to connect in that way, but they often really need to have a team and the right people around them to help them bring that out, help them connect with their audiences, make you believe the lyrics, make you believe what it is they're talking about. And KJ is one of those, not to be cliche, but she's like the wing beneath their wings, you know, when they go out there on those and get on those stages. So I'm not going to talk about it anymore. We're going to talk to KJ about what she does, and she can tell you best. And so I usually like to start off by asking our guests what they call themselves. You know, you might have a certain title. I can look you up, I can read your bio, and it'll say I'm whatever the title is, but it doesn't always necessarily encompass what you think of your work. So what do you call yourself, KJ?
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I call myself a global performance director for creatives and executives. I also say that I am a professional pouncer, one who helps you excavate your dopeness and all of your assets so you leave nothing behind. I am a collector of all your moments to make sure that whatever blind spots you have, that you realize them, you optimize them. I'm an energy wrangler and a child of God.
Why am I sitting here shaking my head? Because I mean, I feel like the energy purveyor, I'm receiving it right now. And it's clear that though this is something that you work extremely hard on, you are naturally gifted in doing. So I think it's always a beautiful thing when you have a natural talent and you're able to cultivate it and turn it into a career. You know, why don't we start with the early years? Often people show signs of talent, their talents and their strengths, you know, when they're still young and in their earlier years. What was your upbringing like? Were you exposed to the performing arts? Was this something you saw in your household? Did you have to go out and seek out entertainment? Like, tell us about what your younger years were like.
Okay, born on the south side of Chicago. I think my home was pretty pragmatic. You know, my parents were pragmatic. I didn't really, you know, see within the household, like their music abilities or my mom, but I will say my mom was a cheerleading coach. And so that I always call her my first hype coach. She say we are nothing alike. You know, she's like, nope, don't call on me. I'm back here. And I'm like, what's up? And so, but in terms of like understanding energy and enthusiasm and really being able to communicate that in a way that makes people feel included, that comes from her, you know? And then I went on to be a part of the pom-pom team and the track team. And so just that kind of collaborative team effort that was kind of impressed upon me very early. And then moving forward, like I love to sing, but you know, don't call me out. Like, don't give me a solo. Don't ask me to be in the front. Like, that wasn't my thing. And that's when I realized there was a little bit of the stage fright, but I was great with, you know, collaborative efforts and the collective. So I was on the choir. I was, you know, in two choirs, like the Soul Children of Chicago, the church choir at Trinity United Church of Christ. I would sing a duet, but not as a solo artist. Even speaking, like I didn't like the idea of being this orator. And we had to do it at our chapel programs at Emmanuel Christian School when I was younger. And so it was like deposited in me. And so I realized early on that even though they made me do it, it did not come without having this adverse reaction, like my body having this adverse reaction to it. It wasn't supernatural. It was like, so not supernatural, but it wasn't supernatural.
Right.
And so, you know, I just thought that was what it was going to be until I realized that I had to outrun it. Like if music and singing was going to be my lot, I had to figure out ways to outrun the fear and the doubt that was associated with it. And for me, if I couldn't be born kind of with this thing, this innate thing, then I knew that repetition was my next best thing.
I just find it's amazing to hear you say that at any point you ever felt uncomfortable with public speaking or just being in front of crowds, because I mean, now this is what you actually do for a living, and you're so incredible and dynamic at it that you would think that, you know, you literally came out of the womb, like, you know, with pom-poms, you know, or just, you know, encouraging all the people like around you, you know? So I think that that's incredible. And I think it's so important for people to hear that, just because something might not be innate to you, if you really want something badly enough, it's really about facing that fear. And like you said, repetition, that's you preparing yourself to confront the fear head on, which I mean, I think that's encouraging to me, because I actually don't love public speaking, but I feel a bit similarly where I just keep saying yes. When, you know, I just keep saying yes, even though I'm like, why do these people keep asking me? You know, it just is encouraging to hear that. Yeah.
A lot of times we dismiss like a gift, or we dismiss an opportunity because we feel like, you know, we weren't born with it and so that's not our thing. But what if you just did it over and over and over again until it just became second nature? And so because I started with that level of uncertainty, it gives me kind of like almost like this empathy that I have.
Oh, yes.
my artist, and I have to release my ego in order to have empathy. You know, I don't care what I went through before I walked in there. I have to now submit to what they went through before they walked in there. So, you know, it's hard to help someone understand and negotiate the feelings and resolve the feelings that come with I'm in front of thousands and millions and I'm in a booth where everybody's looking and I'm constantly being judged. It's hard to give anybody direction on that if you've never encountered it or experienced it, you know. Otherwise you're just talking about what you think it should feel like and how you think you should reconcile it, but it's not coming from a place that you've actually encountered yourself.
Right. I mean, that really speaks to the importance of connectivity, being able to connect with them and then them being able to turn around. When I met you, I don't know if we want to get into years, you know, do we want to be aging?
No. I was a young baby.
Right, right. We were all, you know, like toddlers in preschool when we all, you know, started hanging out by the sandbox. So you were at the time singing. Well, I was working at Star Trek, and yeah. I would see you on a regular basis passing by. I was, you know, an assistant sitting in my like cubicle, and I was just, you know, like kind of ended up by default being the greeting, like the greeting committee. Some people I didn't love talking to, and some people I was very happy to see. You were one of them.
Yes.
So nice. And we would always have a little quick chit chat. And so at the time you were singing with backup for Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake, you were performing with Puff, doing a lot of work with him. I don't even think I knew everything that you were doing. And you were, I remember, I think you were singing solo at the time as well. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, you know, like what you were doing with Puff, and how did you even connect with Bad Boy? How did that all come about?
Yeah, Bad Boy. So it's funny because I would pass you on my way to see Erica. Mm-hmm. And Tamia, yes. Right? Erica Monroe and Tamia.
Erica Monroe, shout out.
Shout out. Yes. With along with all my other BK Chicago people. Mm-hmm. So Puff came into play. There's so many different kind of verticals. I would say number one, Carl Thomas was probably my first introduction to, no, okay, he was one of them. But let me go back to how I got associated with Puff and Daddy's House. So, because it comes from so many different angles. So the first time I got a call to sing on Big's album came from Derek Angeletti.
Okay. Right?
D-Dot. So yes. Then shout out to him. Intermittently, and this is while I'm working at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals.
Okay.
And then intermittently, I would be doing open mics at the Blue Angel with Ron Grant, rest his soul. And Carl Thomas was like the star in the building, right? And so I was always studying him, and he's from Chicago, so he would push me on stage. And every time I would do Anita Baker, I was like, nope, we ain't doing nothing else. Anita Baker, which was right next to Daddy's House.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
This sounds like it was like my daddy, Daddy's House.
Yes. For those listening, that was the name of Puff's studio, recording studio in Manhattan, New York. Yes.
Yep. And so then fast forward to getting a call from a friend of mine from Chicago named Eric Payton, who hit me at like, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock, while I was on 34th Street picking up a gift from Macy's, carrying this heavy bag, and I'm on my way back to Brooklyn, who said, can you come uptown to like the 50s to the studio just to say hi? And I'm like, huh, I'm so tired. But I understood that, you know, and this was one of the, I think the kind of occurrences that kept making deposits into like one of your forces is to show up. Like when you show up, greatness happens. And so I go, Kelly Price is in the room. You know, we had never met before. And we just started, you know, conversing, and she never heard me sing, but she knew that I was a singer. The following week asked me if I wanted to go on tour with Puff. So it was like these multiple things happening. We were like, I was orbiting Bad Boy and Puff. And then I ended up on tour, the No Way Out tour. And it was like Stevie J and Mario Winans. And, you know, it was like Lil' Kim 112, The Lox. It was just a good time. You know, it was like Faith. It was, but that all came and stemmed from Kelly Price, like seeing something in me and us having kind of this, kind of almost like very quickly, this sisterhood, this very like instant sisterhood. Yeah. But then, you know, Carl being able to come and verify, you know, me in that space. And so, yeah, those are all the many different like occurrences that happened that led me to Puff.
So what did you end up telling your boss at work? What did you tell him or her?
I said that I had to go and handle some family business. I just never said it was Puff Daddy and the family.
As in Bad Boy and the family.
That was, you know, family is family.
It's a family.
Yes. So, yeah. And I left for about 3 months on tour, but it was still not clear to me that I was doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, right? It was still like this duality. You know, I was splitting my focus between, okay, woo, yes, I was able to do this tour, but at least I still got my job. Let's see if they'll take me back, you know? And so they held the position for me. And so I considered myself kind of safe and lucky that they held it. And then I was like, but I don't think that this was the mindset after this tour that I should have still had. But I went and worked another 2 years.
Wow.
Started doing background for like on albums like Heavy D. Actually, Heavy D came before the big opportunity. But then after two, it was like Mace, AZ, A+, Capone Noriega, Dead Prez. And so then I finally felt like I was at a point where I was expecting all of these grand results, but I wasn't giving 100% to any one thing. And, you know, it's like a little bit of that kind of conventional way of thinking had kind of seeped in from home. I remember calling my mom and I was like, you know what? I think that I should just bounce and, you know, and I should go on and I just should really focus on the music. And she was like, well, what about your 401k? And what about your stock options? And what about your health benefits? And I was like, huh. And I was like, okay, well, let me keep working. Then I finally got to a point. I was like, enough is enough. And so Cynthia Johnson was, you know, my sister, and she was the first person to really say, you know, you have a voice here. Yeah. You could be singing and working on your own album. And I remember her and I going to like a music convention in Palm Springs. And on the way back, I was like, okay, enough is enough. I gave my 2 week notice period. And I think God just needed to see that I believed enough to jump, right? Cause so much of our activity and our routine is to ask everybody else to kind of approve what we're doing.
Right.
Hey, can you give us this job? Can you give me this opportunity? But then it's like, have you done the pre-approval that needs to take place? So I felt like God needed to see that I would take that jump and that chance on myself. So I gave my 2 week notice period. And within that 2 weeks, I got a call from a girl named a fellow singer by the name of Jana, who was like, do you want to go on tour with Puff in Europe? And I was like, done. I was already, you know, had given my notice. And
look at that.
That at the same time, you know, while I'm still kind of finishing the my time at Pfizer. Yeah, and that's really what started my kind of newfound focus of just doing my own music. So I went from the No Way Out European tour to performing with Carl Thomas, to then going from Carl to Britney Spears, to Janet Jackson, to Justin Timberlake, to just doing all these tours and spot dates with Monica and Ashanti. And, you know, I also have to credit, you know, my management at the time, because when I graduated from FAMU, it was Big John that was in Tallahassee, Florida. John Platt, who's good friends with my friend Shelly, and they were like, sing for John. I was like, I ain't no clown, I ain't just singing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, well, you know, I'm out tomorrow. And at this point, he was at EMI. And he put me with my first management company, Dave and Erskine. Okay. Dave Nelson and Erskine Isaac. And so they were the ones that actually put me in the studio with Heavy D. And yeah.
Well, you just said so many things that I think so many people are going to be able to relate to, because many people, I mean, it takes so much strength and self-belief and overcoming fear. So, so when you made that decision, what did you feel fearful at all? Or were you just like, nope, I can't wait any longer. It's time to go.
Yeah. I think I always do things in spite of the fear. Mm-hmm. I like push through. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. The anxiety doesn't exist. The nerves, you know, don't get to me, but they're just no longer debilitating.
Yeah. So important. And also when you start to do it and you start to see results, it becomes less scary. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I always tell my clients, I was like, the goal here is to put so many victories in the tank that you can access them quickly when those nerves. Those are your proofs of concept. You've done it before.
Right.
It can be done again, you know, because it's all about visualization. If you have nothing that you can imagine that you can pull from that reminds you that you've conquered this thing before,
right.
Like it can be done again, then it's really tough to access and to see yourself doing an additional or having an additional win.
Right, absolutely. That was a certain era in your life. Eventually, lots of us in the business ended up relocating out to Los Angeles. And I know I came here. And then I think a few years later, I remember seeing that you had moved out here. So did you relocate with the idea that you were going to be sort of maybe pivoting or transitioning? Like, what was your plan when you came out to Los Angeles? Was it to pursue what it is you're doing now?
First, shout out to Tony Dofat, who was instrumental in all of my heavy dealings. I've got to give him to you. So I'm trying to think. At the time that I had some opportunities to come to LA, I was working at Sundance.
Okay.
Now Sundance TV.
Okay.
We'd always toured and been in LA, but I'd never got a real chance to experience it beyond just like a couple of days. And so, you know, I think I adapted everybody else who was from New York and Chicago, kind of their impression of LA, which was like, nah, that ain't for me. It's too soft. Like, it's phony. It's fake. I'm from, you know, I live in Brooklyn. I'm from Chicago. I'm like, but you ain't from Brooklyn. So like, you know, I finally was like, huh. And so my dear friend, Nakia Brown, who runs Tridestine Studios, said, you know, I'm working on a movie. Why don't you come out and be a part of it? And so it was, of all the times that I had visited, it was the first time that I felt a brewing, you know, because I felt like I had exhausted my time in New York. I kept looking for reasons that I would still be there, but it's like New York gave me everything I needed to now fully make the jump to the next assignment. At the time, I didn't know the next assignment was LA, but New York gave me it just like hitting that pavement, and it put the chest hairs that I needed. It gave me those. It gave me the armor that I needed. And so I think that I probably stayed a little longer, but you know, God's time is still perfect. I think that a lot of times we equate success with activity, right? But never taking the time to truly assess what part of that activity is actually productive. What's productivity? You know, what's pushing the dial? What's, you know, adding to the tank and bringing value. And so when I realized that the only thing tangible that I was holding on to was exhaustion. Mm. After a while, I was like, I got to reframe and just kind of, you know, figure out how I can get back to the wins as opposed to resting on past laurels. Mm. And, you know, just doing things for the sake of activity. And so coming here and singing in the film, I was like, oh my God, there's something here. So I went to my managers at the time and I said, hey, you know, I think I should go to LA for a month. And they were like, okay, what do you want us to do with the job? And I was like, well, just hold it. I'm gonna come back. We'll see what happens. And they were like, okay. And I think I had poured so much into Sundance in terms of sharing my gift at the Sundance Film Festival for our company meetings, that they were like, well, we can't, knowing what we know, we won't be comfortable having you just sit in this chair and assist and coordinate for us. So you gotta go. So they set me up with meetings. So maybe I'd had like 5 to 7 meetings for that month. But by the time I finished, it was September of 2014, I had so many other promising encounters that it was like the possibility of LA transcended the familiarity of New York. And so I was like, I don't know what it's gonna be. Yeah. But I know that I have outlived my time in LA. And it was like, I said to myself, you are no longer welcome to stay here because you're not pushing for things to make it okay with you being here, but it's, you know, you got more in you. And so take what New York was meant to do for you, which was to elevate. So now that you can continue moving in whatever God has for you next. And so I remember after that month, I went back, I was like, oh yeah, I gotta go. But one of those meetings, I think pivotal meetings for me was with Devon Franklin.
Okay.
I was like, I'm a host, I'm a singer, I can dance, I'm a coach, I'm a director. And he was like, well, if you're all those things, and that's amazing, how would someone know when to call you or what to call you for? You know, without it being so confusing. And it doesn't mean that those things have to be, you know, pushed to the side, but how do you make it easier for someone to know if they got 5 seconds, when to call you?
Right.
I was like, okay. And he was like, and if you're waiting on the yes of everybody else, because I think I had a meeting with Disney on the way. I knew that, you know, kids have been my sweet spot for performance development. And in that moment, I said, you know what, I'm going to focus on performance development, right? I also think I was exhausted from the years of the pursuit as an artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the tap dancing that comes with it, that I was ready to kind of be in more of a service. Mm-hmm. Business, because it shifted my posture, right? So he was like, if God told you to move to LA, then you move. You don't wait for the yes and hold on to every word of everyone else that could possibly, you know, give you your yes. Like your yes had already happened.
Yes. Yeah.
And so once that, you know, had become my new way of thinking, I was no longer waiting for someone else's approval to make that jump. And it really led to so many other open doors, because now my posture in the room was less about, please say something that would make it make sense for me to come. And then it became, I'm already coming here.
Right.
So I'm just letting you know, you have a tool, a resource available to you. If it works, cool. If it doesn't, I'm good too.
Right. Wow. Okay. So once you decided you were like, okay, I'm going to lean into being an artist development coach, a performance director. So what did that look like? Once you made that decision, what did that then entail?
I had an opportunity to go to a vocal boot camp. And while there, you know, all of these vocalists were looking for movement coaches or ways to just communicate and perform in a way that allowed them to occupy their space and leave it all on the stage. And so that's really what started, I would say, you know, and I had other clients through word of mouth that would say, can you help, you know, my artist with stage presence? Because that's really essentially what I was doing at the time. And, you know, that started. And then I knew that they were doing a show on BET called Chasing Destiny, and that was Kelly Rowland and Frank Gadsden, and Stephen Hill at the time was the executive. And I was like, I'm supposed to be on this show. And you know, sometimes people can only see you through one lens, the lens that they, you know, last knew you from.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be mad. Like, my job is to shift their thinking, like, yeah, you know, of me. And I was like, so I can't be mad that they only know me as the singer. So they were like, oh, you want to be on the show, you know, as one of the contestants? I was like, no, I'm performance director. And they were like, oh, okay. What does that mean? And so I stayed on them, sending them kind of new developments in my career. I would just check in like, hey, I know that you guys are doing the show. I just want you to know if you need a performance director. They're like, oh, we got a vocal coach. I was like, that's good. I'm not a vocal coach. That's not what I do. Mm-hmm. And so then I was always like trying to make the distinction for people. Vocal coaches deal with the instrument. I deal with the behavior. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're like, okay. And then finally, I would say after some months, they were like, can you come meet Kelly? And so it started to take shape where I understood that I could make sense also in TV and film.
Okay. Okay.
So I ended up on Chasing Destiny, ended up on a show called Revenge Body as a performance coach at the time. That was Khloe Kardashian's show. They would have contestants that lost kind of confidence in their way and of being and of being present. And so then also, before that, I was an on-set coach. So that month that I spent here and meeting with Disney and Nickelodeon, I ended up as an on-set coach for a lot of the artists. Cause I'm like, okay, they can dance all day. You know, the choreographers for those shows can give them the 8 counts, but my job is to make sure the 8 counts count.
Right. You
know? And so I was on set for Disney's show called Bazaar Bark, and a show, which was Olivia Rodrigo's show.
Okay. Wow.
And then also on a show called Bunked and working with artists on Nickelodeon. And so I was like, huh, where I was very one-lensed on how I saw this thing, you know, going, LA opened me up to so many other areas that I could make sense.
Right, absolutely. And I think what you just said is such a great way to sum it up, because I do find that it seems to be difficult for people, even in the industry, to really understand what goes into artist development and what those components are. People imagine, or people think that it's, you know, yes, it's the vocal coach and it's the choreographer, but saying that it's, what did you say? It's not just the 8 count, it's making sure that
the choreographers, you know, are much, you know, needed in bringing the flow and how the artist flows with the music and their job, you know, which is, it's so much bigger than this, but at the heart of it, they give you the counts. They give you the 8 counts. They give you, you know, how do you make sure that this comes alive? And then my job is to make those 8 counts count. So after you got the moves, what story are you telling? You know what I mean? Is it believable? Do I feel included? Do I care? Do you care? Is it just we watching you in these moves, but they have no heart behind it? So I bring the spirit and the heart. That's what Nas said, I bring the spirit and the soul to And so I think, you know, I've tried to figure out ways to help people understand it. And, you know, that we all exist, you know, and as a part of the development of artists. It's the vocal coach, it's the, you know, it's the choreographer, but it's also the performance director. And I believe that, you know, my mission is to get you out of the blocks from a cold start. You know, working with someone like Lil Nas, we started from a cold start. You know what I mean? It wasn't like he got the running start and they said, okay, come on in. It was cold, right? And so, but he had this desire and this passion and this gift. And I always said to him, like, my job is not to give you something you don't possess already. My job is just to irritate and agitate areas of potential that have just been lying dormant, or to reintroduce you to that potential, you know? And sometimes you just need those people to help agitate for you. And so for me, it's like, I get you out from a cold start. I always run the first leg.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I pass the baton to everybody else.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's, I'm honored that is the work I get to do, you know, and because I am also an artist, yeah. you know, so I've been on those stages. I know what it feels like. I am okay with our sessions being spent on the curb talking for 2 hours, right? Because the external expression that we see by the time an artist gets to tour is nothing but a reconciliation of their internal narrative. What yeah. do you think about yourself? You know what I mean? So we can tell when we watch somebody if they're still in the process of healing or right. if they have resolved all the stuff, you know, do other people have the power to tell their narrative better than they do?
Right.
They've
right.
not reconciled it, right? Or can we talk about all the parts, yeah. all the pieces, even the pieces that you don't feel good about? Let's say that aloud. So that when you're performing, it is not that you're tentative about it. You know what it is already. So can't nobody else, girl, you about to get me excited. Can't nobody else tell you what it is because you know what it is.
Right.
That's when you've got power in the performance.
Yes.
Can't
yes.
nobody hijack it from you.
Absolutely. We're in a time right now, but what you do is so crucial because we're in a time where people are being discovered, you know, whether it's they're being discovered via social media or, you know, they have a popping song on TikTok or something along those lines. And then people want them to turn around and jump on stages and just go and perform in front of audiences. And they're not being given the opportunity to really prepare and really show up as their best selves. You're handling them with care. It's like, okay, you have more than a song,
yeah.
you know?
You are more than a song.
And you deserve to have a career. You got yourself here, which by the way, is not easy.
Yeah.
That one song on TikTok, you know, let's not diminish that. Or like being discovered online is not a small feat. You did a lot to get there, but now you deserve to have people who understand how to take you further, have those people around you to give you the tools that you need. So what you're doing is so important. And I know it. And I'm like, once you see it in action, I see you in action and I see the results, I can't unsee it. Mm. Because then what I end up doing is I'm looking at an artist and I'm like, if they just had some time to work with KJ, if they just had that, you know, you can't unsee it. So anyway, I think that this area is just so important. There's such a need for it. And it really kind of harkens back to Motown and just that the importance. That's why we don't talk about those artists, because they took the time. And you came from Bad Boy, which we saw during Versus. Jadakiss was still talking about Puff. They're like, oh, how are you so good at your book? He's like, because we came from the school of the best, somebody who believed in preparing and developing and all those things. And you obviously had the opportunity to come from that same school. So.
Yeah, that is so true.
Yeah.
You don't know it then. I was just so excited to do what I loved and get a check. You know what I mean? From it, I mean, travel the country, I mean, the world, and do what I loved. I was just like, oh my God, does everybody know about this? So you just know that you're being built for something, you know? And you never know where it's going to land, but I think I was always just staying open, you know? I didn't think it would take me to working with Clive Davis, you know, as his assistant, and so, you know, just making sure that every area of or whatever pivot I found myself in, you know, sometimes it's I try not to make it by default, but sometimes if it's a pivot, like, damn, I'm not getting here, you know, like, well, what's the lesson in it, you know, and how can I learn from this? But yeah.
Obviously, we're talking about your career in entertainment. And you also have been tapped by large companies, Google, Amazon, to go in and to work with their executives. staff, or do you want to describe it? Maybe you have a better way of describing it, but what, how did that begin and what are they seeking from you? Like when they have you come, I guess, to whether it's a summit or a conference they're doing, when they say, we need to make sure we have KJ here as part of it, what is it they're looking for you to do?
Yeah, I think on the onset, it's bringing a new energy to the room. It is exciting their executives, kind of re-inspiring them, giving them jolts of motivation to go back to the reason why they began those jobs and are in those positions. And so, because I think there could be, you know, lulls, and we experience just kind of the mundane day-to-day of what being in corporate America feels like. They are seeking, I think they're seeking the antithesis to calm, which I say I am, just kind of a new, because I always make sure that I make the distinction, I'm not an executive coach. Not executive coach. I'm a performance director that oftentimes coaches creatives and executives, right? Because it's a different application, you know, for both. Right. And my job, you know, and I've seen it where the expectation is that you're going to come in, you know, as this buttoned up person and apply these kind of like methodologies. And I'm like, mm-mm. Like initially it started off as me giving being the espresso shot, the human espresso shot, got them out of, you know, what their day-to-day routines have been. And then it kind of like transformed into, you know, well, I've also got something to say on top of bringing the energy. I want to tell you how you can utilize this so that you walk out of here differently. Yeah. It's like really helping them to get back to the origin of who they are in the core, and excavating their assets. So they understand, you know, what they bring individually, and now it can have real impact collectively. So yeah, it I think spans from, you know, a 20-minute hit to a 2-hour hit. And so, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, hype us up, make us feel good. And then other times, like if I gotta go to my pain points, that's a different presentation, right? And so I utilize the book a lot because there are lessons in there that have truly helped me to get to a point of having aggressive confidence. And that's really what it is helping people individually to just shock their systems, so that they understand that what their gifts, that their gifts are necessary.
I think that's brilliant to have you for you to be invited, into those sorts of, to those sorts of events. I also, you bring up your book. We have to talk about your book. So what made you decide that you wanted to write a book? And what was that process like? How long did it take you to write it? Did you have any help writing it? Was it really challenging? Like, tell us about the process of writing, authoring The Rose Effect.
Yeah, so I would say that the book came from me having all of these opportunities to speak overseas. And, you know, I'd gotten some time with some vocal performers in Ireland and in London and Australia. And I really wasn't leaving them with anything tangible. I was like, all right, I hope it works out. Right. So this had become, I think it got it impressed upon me, like, you got to give something tangible. And I was like, no, I started kind of boxing my own self in, like, no, you're a performance director, stay in your lane. And I was like, I think the judgment of, you know, what if that's not successful, you know? And I remember speaking, actually this past weekend, I spoke at IT Cosmetics and someone expressed not wanting to do something because they didn't want to lose at it. And it kind of goes back to my response to them, which was, well, we're already losing. And so in that, you know, time for me where I was like, oh no, you know, I don't want to be unsuccessful. I don't want to, you know, lose, you know, what people's thoughts are of me maybe, or, you know, lose that respect. And I was like, but you're already losing because you're doing less of what you're capable of doing. And so I decided to just start writing and speaking into an app that would kind of transpose into word day by day. Wow. And sharing, and it really became like lessons that I learned from years of being in the music industry and really years of journeying towards seeing a vision come to life. And I was like, I don't want people to reinvent the wheel. And so if it only just changes the life of one person, you still won, you know? So your job is not to figure out how it will be perceived or what the end results may be. Your job is just to complete the task. If God put it on your spirit, you gotta see it through. And it's not based on other people's definition of what that victory is. The victory is to see it through and to complete the task. Every other victory is the bonus, you know? So it's like, once you take those parameters off of what's deemed to be a victory, then that's when you start moving in a direction that really serves other people, and it serves you, and you become a blessing to other people. And that's really, for me, what it's about.
Right. So where can people find the book? Where can it be purchased?
The book is on Amazon. The audio book is on Audible.
Do you narrate it?
I do.
Amazing.
Barnes and Noble's, the audiobook is also on Spotify and Pandora and Apple Music. Yeah. And so it's everywhere.
That's incredible. Okay. Just a couple more questions. Okay. So the goal of this podcast is to speak to women who have unconventional careers. And a lot of times you are, they have careers and jobs that you didn't learn about. You don't know that they necessarily exist. You don't know what they involve. And so with what you do with your career, KJ, you know, there might be someone who's listening who's like, oh my God, I could totally see myself doing something like that. But I have no idea how to get started. How do I get started? How would I get clients? Like, what advice would you give someone who maybe listens to this podcast and who makes a decision that this is a career that they want to pursue?
I mean, I don't think there's ever one route to take. I think that what has been specific to me was to immerse myself in all sides of the artistry. Mm. That when I do show up, I'm showing up with every tool and every piece of armor that I need to really be impactful in the way that I serve. And so there are many different, I think, entry points. You know, there are like, you know, choreographers that go beyond just, you know, the moves, but then they really dive into the spirit of artists. And making sure that they tell the story. There are, you know, I don't know if acting coaches, you know, if that's an entry point, but I do think that it helps if you yourself regard yourself as a performer in some way.
Right, right.
And you have skill sets that add value and elevate. And so whether that's you studying acting, even if you don't desire to be an actress or an actor, you studying dance. So it's like understanding every entry point that is going to be pertinent to diving into and walking alongside and pouring into an artist, because a lot of times, you know, they harness your energy until their own catches up, you know. Absolutely. So like, you've got to build kind of multiple reserves of what you bring so that you never run out.
Right, right.
So.
Well, I think that somewhat speaks to my next question. So this to me speaks to the idea of a person's secret sauce. Because I feel like that's what you're describing, because it's so much about you and your personal experience. So I don't want to answer this for you, but I do want to ask you. It made me think about it because I feel like you're describing what your secret sauce is. And that's why it's not something that you can just say, hey, here's the manual, or here are the steps that you need to take to get from A to B. What would you describe your secret sauce to be?
My secret sauce is energy, empathy, and expertise.
Last question. This is about you, KJ. You are always on the go. You are on the move. I swear, I look at your Instagram and I'm tired of just looking at it. Okay. I'm like, okay, Nicole, you need to get it together. What you do for a living requires you to show up and show up at 100%. You can't like get on stage or work with a client and not really and bring yourself, you know, like you're at 100%, you know, like I think there's other roles where you're like, oh, I'm not having the best day. Let me go get some coffee. You can't do that. And also you're just, you know, with the travel schedule, how do you take care of yourself? How do you pour into yourself? Because what you do requires you to really pour into other people. And as we all know at this point, you can't pour into other people without pouring into yourself. So how do you take time to take care of yourself, recharge, and just, you know, focus on KJ?
Yeah. I think I had to dismantle, you know, this idea of I did it all in one breath. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, it doesn't serve you. It's like, you know, the idea of being invincible used to be the metric for if you were, you know, like the best. And then I realized that, but one time I worked with, I was working with Lil Nas and I was jumping around and I was like really trying to like get him to see something, and I split my pants and I was like, that's all right. I'm gonna put on something around my waist and I'm gonna go to see, was it Mary and Nas? It might've been Mary and Nas at the Hollywood Bowl. I just kept going. And by the time I drove home, I could barely get out the car.
Wow.
So wow. It's like a microcosm of like being okay with taking tiny breaths. That's what I've learned.
Okay.
You know, as a swimmer, they constantly, to get to the next, before the next stroke, they're taking tiny breaths, right? Wow. And we store up, you know, we wait, we hold on to stuff until we can take that long breath, and that long breath may be a vacation or, you know, just, you know, a party, whatever that is. But I have understood now that what you have to overcome when you hold on to wait to the long vacation means that you got to work double time when you get there.
Right. Right.
But if you take tiny breaths leading up to that. And so this week, one of my tiny breaths was going to a yoga and stretch class. Right. And so I just always prided myself, like, I'm good. I don't need to stretch. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, you can stretch.
Yes.
For me, because it's impossible for you to fully give to the next person if you have not fully recovered from the last.
Right.
It's impossible. And so I think it took friends to be like, you know, you could sit and rest. It took my spiritual coach, shout out to Coach Sheffield, who was like, did you rest today? And I was like, I did. He said, but you know, rest is more than just sitting down. I was like, yeah, I sat here for like an hour. We rested. He was like, but rest also comes with, you know, your mind, resting your mind. And I was like, nah, I mean, who rests their mind? You know what I'm saying? So I was like,
yeah.
my own version of like this, like, I've got to be this hero and this is what makes me great. And now I'm just like, but, you know, it's what people don't see, you know, the fact that you can't get out this car because your legs have tightened up on you, you know, it's like, now that's important to me. Like, you know, it's less about what other people see and more about, well, how do you feel and do you have more to go? And how did saying no serve you, you know, when you didn't want, and it's, I think it's the fear of thinking you'll miss something. Say, you know, no, that's not right for me. And I think once I realized I can't miss nothing with my name on it, you know, if it's for me, I'll get it. And if you can't do it, if I can't do it now, and then you can't do it later, then it's not probably for me. And I trust that everything that comes to me, any opportunity, any artist is unequivocally what I'm supposed to have. And so now I just be like, oh, I don't think that that's gonna work. And trusting that I won't ever be without, because the moment you start making decisions out of lack, you are without.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think what you said is so valuable. And I think often people don't, when people are asked about self-care and how they take care of themselves, they will maybe talk about, I went to a spa, or I went and did this, or, you know, like they went and did an activity. But I think what you saying that you take tiny breaths is so important, because I think that's what people are trying to figure out. Like, okay, I might not be able to carve out this time, and maybe I can't spend the money to go and do this elaborate activity, but what's something I can apply to my day-to-day as I move through the day that is something that I'm doing for myself, that's making me feel better, that's helping me to like just recharge even in the smallest ways to keep going and to continue to be my best self. So I really like that. I think that's important for people to hear. So well, we had a really great conversation. I'm so glad you found time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you for thinking of you experience it, but there's never a moment that lends itself to either sharing the experience or reconciling the experience or just having the platform to speak about it. So this is helpful.
Yeah, good.
There, me too.
Well, we helped each other, because
yeah,
I'm filled with, I got all the deposits, okay? all the deposits. All right, so thank you again, and talk to you later.
Yes, thank you. Bye, everybody.